Hello there. Today is Wednesday, September 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an attack on North Korea. One expert says there are no good military options.
Horrific damage. Even under the best case scenarios that I've seen, the damage and the destruction and the death are considerable.
What's it like for the thousands of U.S. service members based in Japan? Obamacare survives another Republican attempt at repeal. And also ahead, an American pop star is leading a major effort to help hurricane victims. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump said Wednesday the United States is totally prepared for a military option in dealing with North Korea.
We are totally prepared for the second option, not a preferred option, but if we take that option, it will be devastating, I can tell you that, devastating for North Korea. That's called the military option. If we have to take it, we will.
During a joint press conference with Spain's prime minister at the White House, Trump said North Korea must no longer be allowed to threaten the entire world with unthinkable loss of life. Evans Revere, advisor to the Albright Stonebridge Group and a former U.S. diplomat, says there really are no good military options.
There's been a lot of talk about preemptive military action on the part of the United States, a first strike or a preventive military strike against North Korea. As someone who served in the military in Korea, as someone who served there as a diplomat as well, as somebody who's familiar with some of the war planning that's been going on over the years, we know how a war ends on the Korean Peninsula. But on the way there, the damage that is done both to South Korea, the South Korean people, Americans resident in Korea, our military bases in Korea, as well as population centers in Japan, Americans in Japan and our bases there, horrific damage. Even under the best case scenarios that I've seen, the damage and the destruction and the death are considerable. I also don't think that the North Koreans are suicidal. They are many things, but they're not suicidal. The notion that North Korea would start a war on the Korean Peninsula, I think is highly unlikely because they also know how this war ends. So all of this chatter, all of this talk about military options and solving this problem through military means, I think is quite divorced from reality.
Well, with tensions so high, North Korea's neighbors are on edge. And just recently, Pyongyang fired a missile that sent sirens blaring in nearby Japan. In the 72 years since the end of World War II, there are still 56,000 U.S. troops in Japan as part of the post-war pact to protect a demilitarized Japan. And reporter Amy Gutman traveled to the island of Okinawa, where more than half of those troops are based.
It is quite a big troop presence for any country. It's 29,000 U.S. troops on this tiny island of Okinawa. And what's significant about that is when you put it in perspective and context of all the troops that the U.S. has in Japan on the whole, they've got 56,000 troops in all of Japan, including Okinawa. So this is well more than half of that number based on Okinawa. Furthermore, if you look at it by land mass, Okinawa represents less than 1% of Japan's land mass. And yet they're hosting 64% of the bases on the island. So you can kind of get an idea of why it for locals feels very disproportionate. But interestingly, you know, this is more than 70 years after the end of World War II. You know, all those decades of living side by side and people working on bases, and of course marriages have occurred between Okinawans and Americans and still happens. A lot of American soldiers have retired on Okinawa because it's a place that's very much like paradise. So there's this really interesting blended or sort of fusion of cultures that's occurred there. In fact, the funniest thing that struck me was seeing lots of A&Ws all over the island, these hot dog and root beer float restaurants, and they even have functioning drive-ins.
Wow. How much of a concern is there right now for all of this, as far as U.S. troops being there, the rhetoric, the worries over North Korea? You know, we've already seen rockets flying over Japan.
Well, I think it is worrisome. First of all, people living in the region are very used do the rhetoric. And until recently, that's pretty much all they've seen it as. Now, of course, that rhetoric has been stepped up recently on both sides. I think there is more concern more recently. But equally, some Okinawans say that that's another reason why they want a reduced or entirely removed U.S. footprint on the island, because they say, look, we feel like we're more of a target with so many troops here. The reality is that on any given day, there are not really 29,000 troops there, because on any given day, about a third of those troops are on training missions in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And the military does do a very good job of trying to reduce the impact. But still, locals make the point that they feel that this could, in fact, make them more of a target from aggressive neighbors such as North Korea or China.
Is that why they want to reduce the presence of troops?
There are a few reasons why Okinawan residents would like to a troop reduction, if not an entire departure from the island, which really will never happen because the Japanese government likes having the U.S. military there, and the U.S. military like being there. It's an important strategic place for the United States. Some of the reasons why Okinawan residents would like to see troops leave, they talk about the crime. Unfortunately, over the years, the military personnel have been responsible for some pretty heinous crimes. There was a major turning point in 1995 when three U.S. servicemen gang raped a 12-year-old girl. And it was that event that forced the Japanese government and the U.S. military to come up with an agreement to eventually reduce troops by nearly 10,000. There is no timeline for that, and that actually has not begun, even though that was many years ago now. The U.S. military has also returned 12,000 acres of land, with plans to return 3,000 more acres. This is land that's being developed locally, and the government would like to see more of that land returned, because Okinawa is an island paradise. It has amazing beaches, beautiful clear water. It's a subtropical island, and they are getting an increase in tourism from regional visitors, China, and also the mainland in Japan.
They're not focusing their anger toward Americans?
No. As I mentioned, Okinawans have lived side by side with Americans for more than 70 years. They're very comfortable and familiar with the American culture. In fact, one of these bases that they have since reclaimed, they've turned it into this enormous entertainment and shopping complex called American Village. And you walk around there, and you know, there's like a sort of Ferris wheel type of amusement park rides. There's a Red Lobster. I mean, it's really reminiscent of a little American village. But walking around there, it's not just Americans. It's not just, you know, people coming off base. You see locals there. You see mixed families there, obviously intermarriages. So I think there's a real familiarity and comfort level. So locals are not really angry at the Americans. I think they're quite comfortable with them. Mm-hmm. They're really angry at their government. They feel as though they've been treated like second-class citizens. So no, I don't think the anger is really towards Americans, because again, you have so many people who, I mean, everybody in Okinawa has a connection to the U.S. military through a job, through a relative who has a job, through a thriving business that survives from the off-base spending, or through one of these marriages. Everybody is connected to the military there, but it's their own government and the fact that they want to see a reduction in this over-concentration of bases.
Given the heightened tensions between North Korea and its neighbors, and of course the United States, I understand that there was sort of a display of solidarity very openly, with seemingly a very not so subtle message to North Korea.
This past weekend, it was announced that the Air Force sent aircraft from Guam and from Okinawa north of Korea, just sort of wave the flag, as it were. These troops are relevant, and I think it just goes to show why these troops need to be on Okinawa, why it's so strategic, not just for the U.S., but for the allies that they help protect, Japan included.
All right. London-based journalist Amy Gutman, thanks so much for your time. Well, with so many foreign policy challenges dominating the national and international spotlight, it is easy to forget some of the others that are not taking center stage. My next guest says there are tensions bubbling to the surface in the Balkans again, a major point of concern for Europe and its neighboring countries. And joining me now to talk about it is former U.S. Ambassador and CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. You're becoming much more involved with the Balkans. Tell us why.
We had worked in the Balkans in the period of the 1990s when it was, and it's kind of in the focus of everyone's attention. And we had drifted away from that as we had gone worldwide and, like everyone else, had thought that somehow the Balkans were solved. And the short headline here is, no, the problems were put off, not solved. And such issues as governance in Bosnia, the Kosovo-Serbia issue, and the efforts by people to try to still become integrated into the Western institutions is still very much alive and very difficult. So East-West Institute now has a representative in Belgrade, and we're working on those issues I just mentioned, and we're open for others. And we're concerned that people haven't, in Europe and in America, haven't paid attention in recent periods. There are, however, three other countries that are paying a little more attention. One is Russia, that has interests, especially in the energy field, in both Serbia and surrounding countries. One which has been interested especially in Bosnia and other areas for kind of historical and cultural reasons, but is now interested economically. And then the real joker in the deck is China, which has very ambitious plans to work in infrastructure, connecting the port that it now owns in Piraeus, Greece, to Europe.
You just recently wrote an article. It talked a lot about the tensions that are bubbling to the surface now again. What is the situation on the ground there, and are they ethnic issues? Are they geopolitical issues? What seems to be the overriding concern?
I would just put it in three baskets, if you will, and you've named them. One is that there's a kind of a constitutional issue. The Dayton Agreement of 1995, which established the very complicated edifice that is in Bosnia, was not intended to be a constitution, but that's kind of what it's become. It ended the war. It was intended to end the war, which it did, but it wasn't intended to govern the country. And in this sense, what it gave was, in giving everybody buy-in, the different ethnic groups, the Bosniaks, the Serbs, the Croats, what it did is it also created a number of entities that overlap. There's overlapping jurisdictions. And so it's very difficult to have a streamlined, effective government there. It's very hard to invest there, very complicated. And then to add to this messiness, there is still ethnic tension between the mainly between the Bosniaks and the Serbians, Serbs in Republika Srpska. So that's one, which is kind of a constitutional issue, an issue that's been put off. And even though it's, as one diplomat told us when we were recently in Serbia, it's stable instability. That is, it doesn't seem to be on the verge of blowing up. It's also not going anywhere. It's not because of its inefficiency. It's not going towards Europe. It's not going towards improvements in rule of law, and most importantly, it's not going towards economic growth and opportunity for the future. And you sense from young Bosnians that they're fairly pessimistic about their future. Another issue is geopolitical.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Kosovo-Serbia issue, one that since the 1999 war has also just kind of festered and never quite been solved. There was, in 2008, the Declaration of Independence by Kosovo, but it still hasn't been accepted by all the countries in the world. And there are signs that we hope we can see that there may be ways to encourage an organization like the East-West Institute can encourage Kosovo and Serbia to come to agreements that make their work with each other possible, kind of cooperation, but also opens the door for them to go towards Europe, which is the aspiration of both countries. And by going towards Europe, I mean towards the European Union.
As you mentioned, you know, countries in the Balkans still somewhat aspire to EU membership. And
yes,
what is the EU doing to help alleviate any of the concerns in the region?
Well, according to the people in the region, not enough. But well, one thing that people wonder is, in this era of Brexit and this era of wondering about the future of the euro and things like that, does Europe still have the magnetic charm, the kind of the gravitational pull that it had? And it was so important for countries of Eastern Europe and, you know, some of the Balkan countries like Slovenia and Croatia. Does it still have that pull that will allow people in countries, let's take Serbia, to take their medicine, that is to say, to do difficult reforms, but to sell them to their publics by saying, it's worth it because we're going to get into the EU. I think that still resonates. It still is important. It's a cultural thing. We believe that we should be part of the EU. And it's an economic thing. If you're in the EU, you'll have a wealthier life and more chances for employment, things like that. The problem is that the people in the region do claim that both America and Europe have kind of turned their backs on the Balkans because they have other things they worry about more: migration, Brexit, terrorism, other issues. And these people in the region, we hope to be part of the solution to those kinds of issues as well. So to your question, what are the Europeans doing? They're encouraging regional integration, and individual European countries are still investing in the region. But the Balkans understandably want much more, and they want to see an American presence there as well.
Is this something that might come up at the UN General Assembly at all?
It probably will come up as a hearty perennial. It won't be at the top of the list, because there's other things that we can turn to in a minute that I think will be more important. It is, after all, UN action that was kind of the basis for what happened in Kosovo and Kosovo's independence that ended the war in 1999.
All right. Former U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan and Serbia CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. tech companies under scrutiny in the White House Russia probe. Trump says a massive effort is underway to help the Caribbean storm victims. Construction of a border wall prototype begins in San Diego. And Trump again denounces football players' protests. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Senate Republicans Tuesday abandoned their latest attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, after it became clear the bill would be defeated if brought up for a vote this week. Senate Democrats, who have fought against a series of Republican health care proposals since June, expressed relief and a desire for a bipartisan solution to fix Obamacare's shortcomings. Hundreds of protesters, many with disabilities, also came in wheelchairs to Washington to object to the latest Republican effort. And joining me now to talk more about it is Los Angeles-based healthcare attorney Harry Nelson. So why have they been unable to keep their promise of repealing Obama's healthcare law?
I think the successive discussions have gotten more and more public attention. So the wheelchair-bound protesters are sort of representative of vocal objection to some of the changes and a public awareness that has really locked in politicians who previously supported repeal and replace. People like Senator McCain have really been, sort of energized to salvage it just because of the clarity that whatever comes next is going to be bad for a lot of folks.
What did you make of this bill from what you could see of it?
The bill was interesting because it was really the first attempt to sort of address the equity issue between the states that expanded Medicaid with 32 states that had gotten a lot of federal money, and the 18 Republican-led states that had declined Medicaid expansion and were getting significantly less federal dollars. So I thought it was interesting in that respect, and it was also interesting in that it was trying to not just undo parts of the Affordable Care Act, but just to give states much more power about how to administer it. And I think this bill would have had a lot more traction if it's what the Republicans had led with 5 months ago, but I think that they lost some credibility with the public, and which I think is what drove Senators Collins and McCain and the others who came out with opposition. They basically came a little bit too late to a proposal that would have maybe passed muster back in March or April.
It sounds like, though, it would have taken health care away from a lot of people, and it certainly would have put in question the issue of pre-existing conditions.
The Congressional Budget Office did not have time to score how many million people would have lost coverage, but it was clear that millions was what the O said were going to lose coverage. It was going to cut Medicaid spending substantially, and that's ultimately the one of the key factors that drove the defeat of each of the bills in the Senate. And so on balance, even though this bill was sort of designed to be more attractive to more members of the Republican caucus, it still was going to be a net loss of access to health care for too many Americans.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Los Angeles-based attorney Harry Nelson of Nelson Hardiman and the author of the book From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Joining us now for the latest on what's trending on social media is Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, anything new?
Oh, there's always something new, Laurie.
Okay, good.
But there's always more of the same, too. It's just kind of things get transmuted as they develop and evolve. And we have two of those stories today. So the first one, of course, is about President Trump and Twitter. Loves using Twitter, on Twitter all the time, and recently caught some flack because of a tweet that he sent where he was talking about the North Korean foreign minister speaking at the UN General Assembly. And he said that if he echoes the thoughts of Little Rocket Man, referring to Kim Jong-un, then they won't be around much longer. Now, a lot of people took issue with this, saying it was a threat against North Korea.
Right.
He was making a threat
of
striking, bombing them, attacking
them.
And that violates Twitter's terms of service. You're not allowed to make threats against people. So a lot of people have been saying that Twitter needs to remove this tweet because it violates their terms of service. Well, Twitter has spoken out in a series, where else, of tweets. They had actually six tweets that they said, some of you have been asking why we haven't taken down the tweets mentioned here. We hold all accounts to the same rules and consider a number of factors when assessing whether Twitter tweets violate our rules. And they said among the consideration is newsworthiness. They said because this tweet was newsworthy, they did not take it down. However, they did say that they are always trying to do better and that they will do better in the future. And they're trying to stick with their fundamental principles and trying to make sure they better align with what their values are. So that's the answer, because President Trump's tweets are newsworthy and noteworthy. They are not going to be taken down, even if they are threats. So
interesting. All right.
When you're in the public eye, you get a little bit of a different set of rules to play by,
I'm sure,
I suppose.
That will make him very happy.
I'm sure it will.
And what else is going on? Anything?
Yes. So another story that we've talked about in the past, the Trump administration wants to start monitoring social media for people coming to the United States, trying to seek visas to come to the United States. And we've talked about this on multiple occasions, about how exactly they're going to implement this, when they're going to roll this out. Well, we have an answer now. They said October 18th, 2017 is when they're going to start looking at social media for people looking to come to the United States.
Hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is this information published in the Federal Register says that they're not going to just look at social media. They're going to look at search results. They're going to look at information provided by other countries. So this is much more expansive than they initially said. And one thing that has a lot of people talking is they said that it's not just people who come to the U.S. It's people who are already in the U.S., visa seekers, and people who have visas that are in the U.S., and people who communicate with immigrants. So that opens it up to potentially a huge amount of people, including U.S. citizens, naturalized U.S. citizens who are communicating with their families in a foreign country, or potentially Americans who are communicating with people who have immigrated here. So a lot of people are concerned about this. No word yet from the social media companies on what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are feeling they're going to fight this in court. So just because they say it's starting on October 18th doesn't mean it's going to happen on October 18th. This is going to be a long, protracted fight, just like the travel ban. And I think we're going to be in for lots of court battles and lots
of back
and
forth. We've had a lot of those and a lot of drama.
We have had
lots of
court battles, lots of drama, and a lot of it involving social media.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Turning now to Hollywood news, we are joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. Nicole, many people really suffering in the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, just really flattened by two major hurricanes in a row, and the last one being Maria, which made a direct hit on the island. But it does sound like one major celebrity is really stepping up.
Yes, Jennifer Lopez has stepped forward and said that she will be donating $1 million to hurricane relief efforts in both Puerto Rico and all of the Caribbean. She will be making this donation with her boyfriend, Alex Rodriguez, who is from the Dominican Republic. So she said in this news conference that she has not heard from every single one of her family members in Puerto Rico. She has aunts and cousins and uncles still living there. And she said her concern is not just for her own relatives, but for the entire country and everybody in that country as well. So she's really showing that she has a big heart and she wants to do everything she can to help Puerto Rico get back on their feet.
This was a monster storm, and, you know, boy, people are suffering.
And it's nice to know that a lot of people in Hollywood are stepping forward and trying to help people who may not be able to, who may not have the resources. We saw a lot of donations come from Hurricane Harvey relief efforts as well. So people are really stepping up and just being more than your everyday celebrity. They're helping where they can.
Oh, that's great. That's great for sure. We've got some other celebrity news as well. Prince Harry, everybody's watching the royals. And this one, he's been single for a long time, but it sounds like he's got a new girlfriend. And they're actually must be getting a little more serious because they're stepping out in public.
Yes, they are. They are. Prince Harry is over in Toronto, which is currently the hometown of his girlfriend, American actress Meghan Markle. She lives there for most of the year because she's filming her series Suits there. So he's there now doing the Invictus Games, which is a sporting event that he does every year for wounded warriors. And while he was there, he was spotted holding hands with his girlfriend, which is something that royals don't do. We never really see William and Kate packing in the PDA when they're out and about in public. So it was pretty scandalous that Harry was holding hands with his girlfriend because he is a representative of the British monarchy. It's not necessarily a rule that he cannot be affectionate with her. It's just a little bit frowned upon, but it is causing quite a stir because it is such a public statement. So a lot of royals experts are saying that an engagement is probably coming pretty soon.
Wow, that would be a big deal.
It would. An American actress marrying a prince. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better fairy tale.
That's for sure. Rare.us content editor Nicole Muscella, thank you. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Liberia has come a long way since the end of its second civil war in 2003. Since then, the economy grew by more than 7% per year. Per capita income rose by nearly ninefold, and life expectancy went from 53 to 61 years. Liberia also made notable progress toward democracy. This includes the nurturing of a vibrant media and active civil society, civil service and public financial management reforms, and the rehabilitation of infrastructure, said USAID Acting Assistant Administrator for Africa, Cheryl Anderson. Over the past 10 years, the United States, Liberia's largest bilateral donor, has dedicated significant resources to help Liberia remain on a path of democratic governance and stability. Our programs in Liberia address the underlying structural and institutional problems that gave rise to 14 years of civil strife and war, while at the same time tackling the country's more immediate development needs, said Assistant Administrator Anderson. On October 10th, Liberians will go to the polls to elect a new government. It is a historic election because if it is successful, it will result in the country's first peaceful democratic transition in more than 70 years. It also will mark a critical milestone in Liberia's progress toward a stable democracy. However, Liberia's National Elections Commission is facing a number of challenges that could complicate the elections, said Daniel Yamamoto, Acting Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. This includes poor infrastructure, inadequate funding, and heavy rain that could complicate election logistics. We are providing comprehensive programming support to the Liberian National Elections Commissions, civil society organizations, and media outlets in the run-up to the 2017 elections. In addition, our ambassador is meeting with candidates running for president to emphasize the importance of peaceful elections and a transition in government that builds upon the progress made in the last 12 years, he said. This election is critical, not just for what the transition represents, but because it will give Liberians the opportunity to elect a president well-equipped to lead the country towards a peaceful and prosperous future, he said. We look to Liberia's election as another positive step forward for democracy in West Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.